the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the recording of the panel session on aid, development and conflicts in the Asian frontier from the 2015 Australasian Aid Conference. Presentation slides can be found at devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
Okay, morning everybody. I think we'll get started. Just first of all, my name is Jonathan Goodhand. I'm a Professor of International Development at University of Melbourne. I have a split personality. I'm also a Professor of Conflict and Development Studies at SAAS, University of London. And I'll be doing a session. The session today will be with Bart Clem, who's a lecturer in Development Studies at Melbourne University, and Rachel Diprose, who's also a lecturer. Both of us, we're all new to Melbourne. But what we're going to talk about today is the subject of conflict development and borderlands. And just a very brief bit of introduction. This is based partly on research the three of us have been doing over many years, in particular at borderlands. It's also linked to some current work I've been doing with the World Bank, and a project that we are just starting now with the University of Melbourne and SAAS, which will involve doing empirical work on additional borderland areas. Now, what are we interested in doing? What's this about? We intend in this session to address these questions, and this is also what the bigger research programme is trying to look at, about what a borderland perspective is, why we think it's important, and what are its theoretical and also policy implications. And our hunch here is that, first of all, theoretically, this is starting from the margins, throws up some interesting angles and lenses for exploring development, conflict, and state building. We think these processes look different from the margins, and they may help us rethink some of the theoretical frameworks that we work with to understand these things. But we also think, in policy terms, it's very important. If we look at the celebratory accounts globally of a world of declining conflict, eradicating of poverty, when we start looking at the subnational level, the picture looks quite different. Particularly if you look at Asia, an area of strong developing states, but at the subnational level, there are still many ongoing subnational conflicts. There are deep areas of poverty in many of these borderland regions. There are also areas that export insecurity and also creators of environmental problems. So there's kind of a range of linked intractabilities in many of these borderland regions, and we think for policymakers, they need to start grappling with these issues, and we think they haven't done so far. We think many policymakers suffer from borderland blindness, that they think like estates. They see the world in national terms. They suffer from what we might call methodological nationalism. The statistics they use are at the aggregate state level. Their relationships are based on state-to-state relationships, the way they organise themselves around country teams, country budgets. A lot of the things that are happening out in borderland areas may remain illegible or difficult for state actors to see, where there are illicit economies and illegal economies. And people, as James Scott writes about, seek to stay out of the archives. They are purposely illegible to the state in these borderland regions. So we think that these areas are incredibly important. They're also interesting because they're often areas not just of insecurity and global public bads, if you like, but there are also areas of incredible innovation and experimentation. New forms of political institutions emerge, new political economies emerge in these areas. And we think one way of starting to grapple with and understand this conceptually is to bring together the three different perspectives, thinking about power, thinking about space, thinking about time. I think what we think the added value of this is that we bring these things together when they're often not brought together. And so we know in the development literature there's been a big emphasis in recent years on political economy, on political settlements, on limited access orders, the political economy of conflict. And the World Development Report of 2011 is emblematic of this. But we'd argue it's still spatially blind. It's not thinking enough about the spatial dimensions of limited access orders. The spatial dimensions of how rents are distributed, not only within a particular country, but transnationally. We also think that thinking about space is very important. So that leads us on to the second point. And the World Development Report of 2009 you know, was one of the examples of this spatial turn in development policy. But we would argue there wasn't enough emphasis on power in that study, that borderlands were treated as lagging areas to be integrated, when often we see in many parts of the world this integration, these processes of development into borderland areas may be part of the problem. State building is seen as this diffusion of power outwards from centre to periphery, which we also think is a very simplistic way of understanding state building. And the final point is we think it's important to think about time and history, not only history as background, but history as how it creates and lives on in the present, but also thinking about time, moving away from this kind of teleological understanding of time, of linear time. In borderland areas, things may move in non-linear ways through moments of sudden rupture, sudden change, punctuated equilibrium. And finally, before handing over to Bart, I mean, when we're talking about borderlands and frontiers, I won't go into kind of definitions now, but we're interested both in frontiers where these kind of liminal zones where the states, what's happening may be illegible to the state. And think of the American frontier as the classic example, but Kopitov writes about African frontiers as these liminal places in between emerging states. We're also interested in borderlands as the classic areas that are straddle an international border. And finally, we might be interested to think about going beyond borders or within the borders of the state. There's lots of bordering practices going on beyond the state. Think of offshore detention centres. Or there are bordering practices going on within states. Think of biometric testing and so on. So we're interested in bordering processes more generally. Now, finally, not all borderlands are the same. And we've started playing around with ideas about how to think about different kinds of borderlands, some which are more unruly than others, some which are more violent than others, some which are more integrated than others, and trying to place cases and compare across cases. I won't discuss this any further now, because I want to hand over to Bart, and then we'll get into the case studies. Okay?
Good morning, everybody. My name is Bart Clem. It's really fun to be here. It's been a great conference so far. I'll just pick it up right where Jonathan left off. Essentially what we're saying is borderlands and frontiers are not residual areas that are derivative of what happens at the centre. It just happens a little later and a little bit less intensively. On the contrary, a lot of the big things we're trying to worry about today actually are centrally happening in borderlands. In many ways, frontiers and borderlands are central to what happens in the world. If you want to think about state building and governance, it very often it's not about a capital, it's about what happens in peripheral regions and borderlands. Security arrangements, peace processes, there's a lot of issues there that actually tend to get focused on capitals, but in fact, the crucial dimensions often happen in the more peripheral areas. Migration, another key issue, obviously. We think about migration as country A, country B type of thing, but very often there's much more fuzzy lines between countries and within countries about where people go and come from. Legal and illegal economic flows. Clearly, trade, crucial issue. But illegal economies often are no less important. And in the Afghan case, I think, we'll show that very clearly. Of course, often frontiers and borderlands are poor regions with destitute populations. At the same time, they can be very profitable. Windfall profit because particular arrangements, particular insecurities, particular absences of the state create particular economic opportunities that actually make it a very profitable region to work in. Often rural and remote, but we also see boom towns happening in particular places where you have a resource boom going on or particular economies are emerging around a border, for example. So they're not leftovers. They're actually pretty central, except we often don't think of them that way. We think of them as regions that need to be integrated, but in many ways, they're ahead of the game. So today's panel consists of three presentations. Jonathan will kick off with a case study of the Afghan-Tajik borderland, looking mainly at drugs and development, drug economy. I will follow with a case study on Sri Lanka, northeastern Sri Lanka in particular. And Rachel Dibrose will close the session with a case study from Central Sulawesi, Indonesia. Now, in short, just to give you a heads up of what you might be expecting today, the first case study will look at the drug economy. And essentially arguing that counter-narcotics gets it wrong in many ways, and in many ways misunderstands the political economy of drugs, and actually are thinking about instability and order maybe needs to be recalibrated if you look at the way drugs economies really work. The second case, Sri Lanka, is interesting because Sri Lanka is a strong state. It's a small country, and in many ways it's a good performer when you think about development indicators. At the same time, it's struggling immensely with integrating its own frontier, and it's becoming clear after the war that integrating a frontier doesn't mean pacifying it. In many ways, it aggravates the problem. And finally, we end up on a slightly more upbeat case study in Central Sulawesi, which had major conflict, but in fact has managed to resolve it in somewhat satisfactory ways. And to some extent, it is bad because they got it right, because they managed to integrate in the correct, in a way that actually managed to diffuse the real issues going on. So it's about different ways of integrating frontiers with the center, if you like. And just to come back to the graph very quickly, basically the Afghan Tajik case started on that angle, underdeveloped yet stable, because of the way the war evolved and the drug economy came up, it actually became much more conflictual and eventually became more developed. And it moves across the spectrum. They're not stuck in space. And in many ways, this is a simplified movement. It actually moved back and forth. The Sri Lankan case started as a classical peripheral region with conflict. After the defeat of the Tamil Tigers, it's moved up. It's become more integrated and in some ways less conflictual. But in many ways, that's about the overt violence. The underlying issues, in fact, have been reproduced in the way the so-called peace has taken effect. And then our most positive case, if you like, Sulawesi, also in that quadrant of being less integrated, more conflictual, and gradually moving up, perhaps in a way that should give us a little bit of hope. Don't laugh, you're the only one that should be telling the positive story. So that's basically the setup today. I'll hand right back to Jonathan for the first case study. We'll do all three presentations at once. Rachel will try and wrap up a few of the things that sort of cut through the three cases, and then we hope there'll be a good half hour, maybe a bit more, for discussion after that. Let me go right to if this works.
Keep an eye on the time for me. Okay, so we're going to go jump straight into the to looking at the Afghan Tajik case. Now, I'm going to do this very, very quickly because it's clearly I've got to simplify. But very briefly, some background. This is based on research that goes back to the 1980s that I was doing in the northeast of Afghanistan in the 1980s. And there's been subsequent research that I've been involved in 2007, 2013, and 2014. And it's been multi-sited in Badakhshan, but across the border in Tajikistan as well. And the kind of the interest that's kind of motivating, the kind of question that's motivating this research, which is in its current phase, is about drug economies and about how counter-narcotics efforts influence political institutions, violence and development. And what I'm really interested in is the kind of broader question of how do war economies become peace economies? Very often what we see is the mutation of war economies into criminalised peace economies. And I think one of the keys to understanding these processes, the dynamics around the transition, is the role of borderlands. So, Afghanistan, the area I'm looking at, is both a key choke point and a gateway for the so-called northern routes of this opiate trafficking from the zones of production in Afghanistan through to the zones of consumption, primarily in Russia and Europe. 25% of opiates from produced in Afghanistan go through this route, and you probably all know more than 90% of the world's opiates are produced in Afghanistan. If you're ever in the position to do this, if you're in Korog, and you want a kilogram of heroin, it's going to cost you, well, at least the last time we did our research, it was $4,000. By the time it gets to Moscow, it's $20,000. So you probably make a lot more than you would as an academic. Where are we talking about? We're talking about this. It's an area up in the northeast corner of Afghanistan. It's an extremely mountainous. It's where the Hindu Kush and the Pamirs come together. It's a sparsely populated area. On the Tajik side, Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast has in the order of 190,000 people, and Afghan Badakhshan has 900,000. It's high mountains divided by valleys, and the border is the Panj River. The area is predominantly occupied by Ismailis. So the Ismaili branch of Islam centred around the leadership of the Alim Khan. So this is a kind of a marginal people. It's the classic James Scott. He talks about how religious heterodoxy heads for the hills. It moves to the highland areas, the least fertile areas. And I'm going to tell you very quickly a kind of a story in what I've called 4.5 chapters, which is about the changing dynamics around the borderland and how drugs has been central to this. Now, if we start off in the kind of the pre-state origins of this area, it was the kind of classic, what James Scott writes about, as a frontier shatter zone. It's an area that was marked with great political fluidity. People who lived in the Palmyres usually paid tribute to kind of multiple centres of power. There are interconnections. It was part of one of the Silk Routes, so it had a regional, a transnational identity. But with the Great Game and the emerging Russian and British empires, it became eventually squeezed between two empires, border delineation, and then two state-building projects. And the drawing of the border in 1895, it was a kind of classic case of how, we know borders are very artificial, but the delineation of a border has these material effects. And in this case, there were very stark material effects. It divided up the Palmyres into these two zones, one which was kind of Soviet space, which was developed. It was seen as a strategic borderland. There was a lot of investments in infrastructure and roads, in military posts, in modernization and collectivization. On the other side of the border, Afghan Badakhshan remained this kind of very marginal autarkic region within this kind of Pashtun-dominated state. And in 1949, during Stalin's period in power, the border itself was finally closed. So the third chapter, so the second chapter was about this segregation and separation, a very stark example of what borders can do, leading to these differential state building and development effects. The third chapter is what I call the Frontier Strikes Back. This was when civil war was raging in both countries in the 1990s. It started earlier in Afghanistan, but by the early 1990s in both countries, civil war was raging. Both countries were divided into competing political and military factions. And in many ways, this was a return to the past of the frontier region, of new kind of connections or old connections, with the border itself becoming open again. On both sides, a new military class emerged of militias, of commanders, military fronts. And there was a lot of movement backwards and forwards across the border. The Palmyris, who had emerged as a military force to keep out the government opposition, the government forces in Dushanbe, became a very important force and also established base areas in Afghanistan. The Afghan Mujahideen also established links across the border. And the other thing that was starting to flow at a much higher rate, it started in the 1980s, but by the 1990s it was really growing massively, was the drug economy. And this was linked to some structural shifts in the nature of the conflict in Afghanistan. The end of superpower funding meant that military fronts inside Afghanistan had to start generating more resources internally. So how did they do that? Well, it was in Badakhshan, there wasn't much choice. There was either lapis lazuli, so that was precious stones, which were mined in Badakhshan, or the drug economy. And so during this time, drug cultivation in Badakhshan massively increased. And this became the central source of rent, both for the Afghan Mujahideen and for the Palmyri commanders the other side of the border. In order to be able to fund the war effort, to fund the militias, capturing and controlling the rents from the drug economy came central. For the Ismailis in the border areas, when they talked about this period, they talk about this period as the dark years, that it was the years when the Tajik Mujahideen came into the border areas in order to establish control to enable the drug routes. They did this through fracturing political coalitions within the Ismailis. And during this period, there's a lot of intra-Ismaili fighting that went on, and also a lot of repression of Ismailis by Tajik commanders. If one to characterise the drug economy in this period, it was very much a cottage industry, in the sense that there were low barriers to entry. Well, many people could get a stake at the border. The border was controlled by this kind of mosaic of competing commanders. The flow of drugs across was primarily at this time opium rather than heroin. And it went across in small shipments in a kind of capillary action. So the drug economy reflected the political architecture of the time, which was highly fragmented. And one final thing that that kind of changed, shifted the dynamic again, was in this border, these border areas became the key to the, very, very important. And drugs, particularly along the eastern borders of Badakhshan, which went into the Pamirs and then up to Osh and to Kyrgyzstan through that route, this became the critical route. Also important at this time was the Taliban taking more and more control over the rest of the country. And so this closed off other routes, say for trade to Kabul and whatever. And finally, when the Taliban introduced a drugs ban in 2001, basically Badakhshan became the only area where drugs cultivation was happening in Badakhshan. So again, it led to the massive increase in the drugs cultivation. The fourth chapter is the post-war settlements in both countries. Peace settlements were first signed in Tajikistan in 1997, and then the Bonn Agreement in 2001 in Afghanistan. What impacts did this have on political structures and the drug economy? Well, first of all, in the Tajik case, drugs were actually central to the dynamics around the political settlement. There's a formal agreement including the 30% of positions in the government for the opposition figures, but the invisible deal, I mean, Alex de Waal writes about peace settlements less as legal texts than as rental agreements, and this very much captures what the settlement was in Tajikistan. Essentially, there was the divvying up of the rents around the drug economy. And there were a whole number of secondary political settlements between central state elites and peripheral elites, including the Pamirs. And essentially, the Pamirs were given a free hand to monopolize the drug rents along their border, as long as they didn't get involved in political action at the center. So there was an unspoken deal between the central state and the Pamirs. On the Afghan side, there was also, and this, just to finish off on the Tajik, this kind of deal lasted for a long time, and it stabilised political relationships. Drugs were, if you think of Douglas North's work on limited access orders, whereby a political coalition emerges, and the way to deal with the violence problem is to build this coalition and to share out rents. And so this was the deal in Tajikistan. The rents were drugs, and also there were a number of other rents, including cotton and aluminium, which were monopolised by the state. On the Afghan side, for the Tajiks in the northeast, the political settlement basically favoured them, was a favourable one for them. And so, certainly in the initial years, Badakhshan experienced a stabilisation. New political settlements emerged involving the central state actors, provincial elites, and local actors at the local level. And drugs were a very important part of this. So sharing out the drugs, the rents around the drug economy was very important. And the nature of the drug industry changed in this time. It became more professionalized, more integrated, more centralized. It wasn't a cartel, but there was a level of predictability, and there were higher barriers to entry. If you wanted to get involved in drug trafficking, you had to have high-level patrons within the state. And so drugs were essentially was a glue that held together these political settlements. And perversely, on both sides of the border, counter-narcotics policies played a role in this stabilization. They strengthened the state's capacity in Tajikistan to take out competitors, building its policing capacity, building its border regulation capacity. Similarly, in Afghanistan, eradication policies and interdiction policies were used by the more powerful to take out the weaker, smaller players. And so you see a consolidation of the drug economy, a centralization in many ways of the political settlement. And it lasted I'd argue, up until the mid to late 2000s. And I call this chapter 4.5 because it's still going on. We don't know. It certainly hasn't played itself out. But the story is really of a growing insecurity. On the Tajik side, the Rahman regime, many observers would say, is trying to renegotiate or impose a new political settlement. And there was violence in Korog in 2012, which many interpret as an attempt by the government to loosen Pamiri commanders' control over drugs rents. On the Afghan side, it's become much more fragile and fragmented. The presence of the Taliban in Badakhshan now, perversely the role of elections, have shortened the life cycles of alliance making and destabilised the kinds of arrangements that had pertained until the mid-2000s. Growing uncertainty over the international withdrawal all contributed to the fracturing of political alliances and the nature of the drug economy changing in many ways, not back to what it was in the 1990s, but certainly something more fragile and in some ways more democratised, more open to other players. So I'm going to finish off just with a few quick points and, you know, the kind of, so what? What's this kind of remote borderland? How does it talk to broader issues around borderlands and state building more generally? First of all, I think it shows that the importance of when one's looking at limited access orders, which is a useful framework, to look at it spatially. I mean, in this case, I think we can see a transnational limited access order. And if we think only in national frameworks, we miss a lot of what's happening. It's actually on the borders where the stakes are highest. And the ability to control those borders is the key to being able to control the rents. And so that's why often the battles are most intense in the border areas. Also, events in one side of the border have this cascade of effect across. So in Korog in 2012, the violence there led to a whole range of impacts in Afghan Badakhshan, including changing district police and right up to the provincial level, and even state-to-state interactions. So we need to think about the transnational dimensions of limited access orders as well as spatial dimensions. Secondly, it's received wisdom, certainly in the kind of the counter-narcotics literature, that drugs are necessarily a symptom of fragile state fragility or a state breakdown. And this research shows there's no a priori relationship between state breakdown and drugs. At certain points, drugs have actually contributed to the stabilisation of relationships. And in many ways, the existence of drugs in the border areas has exerted this gravitational pull on the state. It's pulled the state out to these areas, because now it's no longer an autarkic, poor, marginal borderland that can't be profitably administered. It's got valuable resources, and controlling those resources is important. So in some ways, it's actually attracted the state out to the border areas in order to negotiate or to try and impose settlements in these border regions. So we think we need to think carefully about this oscillation of power backwards and forwards between the centre and the periphery. And I think the key here is the role of brokers who kind of occupy the synapses between the centre and the periphery, the national level and the local. The way these brokers are a point of friction, but also they're a lubricant. So they allow these kinds of relationships to happen. I've gone over my time, so I'm going to finish off. But two final quick points is that what's happening in the border areas is not just a question of poverty, of maldevelopment, that actually the political process, the economic process in the hinterlands are often paying for economic processes in the centre. So the house building, the construction industry in Dushanbe and Kabul, a lot of it is based on the drug economy, you know, on processes happening out there in the borderlands. And even in the borderlands, there are processes of investment going on. The bazaars are growing. There's construction going on. There's commodities being bought and sold. And then finally, that I maybe in the questions you can talk about this more, but the international policies have often very perverse or unintended effects in the borderlands. I mean, a borderland perspective encourages us to think more carefully about the distribution of the costs and the benefits. Counter-narcotics policies in many ways have have they can stabilise political relationships, but not in the ways intended, or they can destabilise political settlements and also undermine coping strategies of poor Afghan farmers and local people. So I'll finish there.
Thanks, Jonathan. That was great. So I'm going to take you on a little trip from Afghanistan to Sri Lanka, which is a similar region, yet very different. We're going from a landlocked place to an island. We're going from one of the poorer countries in the world to a middle-income country. We're going to a country with pretty problematic histories of democracy and the state, to a country that also has a problematic history, but actually has a very long history of democracy and a pretty well-functioning state. In many ways, Sri Lanka was a promising country in the 60s and 70s with high development indicators and a pretty well-functioning state. A proof that you could do it, you could grow and have a functioning democracy. And as we know, that's not quite how it turned out to be. The war evolved, the Tamil insurgency, a few other things happened on the way, and Sri Lanka actually proves to have a lot of difficulty dealing with its own frontier. Because that's the other thing, we're going from an international borderland to a frontier. Of course, there is an international border dimension to Sri Lanka's issues as well. But what I'm talking about here is the northeastern frontier. It's not a classical borderland in the way Jonathan talked about, but it's a peripheral area that over history the state has tried to integrate into the system, and that has gone with little fissures and tensions. I'm doing this research with a number of people, but I want to mention Tiruni Kelagama at the University of Zurich, who's doing another part of the empirical work than I am. Very much still ongoing, so this is in some ways a sort of getting a few things together from earlier research and trying to mold it into a coherent story as we are still doing the research. But a key point, I suppose, here is that if you look at the national picture in Sri Lanka and the statistics and the kind of presentation that we started this conference with fairly hopeful statistics, Sri Lanka would be a very good performer. If you look at the subnational level, you look at what happens in the northeast, actually the picture looks quite different. So it's really important to go to that subnational level. It's helpful to think of the northeast not purely as an insurgency or an ethnic issue, but as a frontier. This is not something that just started in the 70s or 80s. There's a long history of the northeast being like a frontier. And Jonathan mentioned authors like Turner, the Tiber frontier, Kopitov, the interstitial frontier in Africa, Wittfogel, the German theorist on hydraulic despotism in Asia, the way irrigation systems are used to expand the state into peripheral areas. Very much the case in Sri Lanka. So the point I'm trying to make in this presentation is that frontier integration, that's the classical way of dealing with the frontier, integrated in order to generate welfare and control it, involves many parallel and therefore also contradictory processes. And attempts at ruling and pacifying the frontier often create controversial and perverse and unintended effects. So just a few snapshots. We're not going to go into the whole history of Sri Lanka, obviously. This is a colonial map of Sri Lanka when Britain hadn't quite completed its project, early 19th century. Coastal control. Kandy Kingdom remains in the middle, and important to note that the way Britain dealt with the northeast was slightly different from the way it dealt with the south. So you see a sort of frontier area appearing between the reddish and the white, where this sort of colonial expanse moves in, and eventually, of course, it did. Second map is a rainfall map. You see the wet zone in the south, upcountry, and then the dry zone, which is actually, yeah, depends on how you measure, a bit smaller than the white here, in the north and east. So there's an ecological difference between the northeast and the rest of the country. Then, of course, it makes sense to intervene in the dry zone with water. So there's a long history of irrigation schemes in Sri Lanka. This is where Wittfogel hydraulic nationalism comes in. But after independence, there's been successive programs. The modernist era, big dams, displacing people from the areas underwater and landless farmers from the south to the north, where you bring water, divert water to the northeast, create irrigation, create livelihoods, and of course populate the jungle in the process. Now this became very problematic because that also meant it wasn't just bring modernist development from the center to the periphery. It also meant bring Sinhalese to a Tamil-speaking region. So it changed the ethnic demography and was therefore seen as a colonization attempt, ethnic colonization, if you like. Now the fourth map shows you around 2000 what the military control looked like. And dark red areas are areas the LDTE fully controlled, the Tamil Tiger Rebellion. The orange areas are kind of fuzzy areas where both the military and the rebels had control. So you see a convergence of these different maps that kind of map onto each other, and maybe that's not a coincidence. As you probably know, in 2009, the LDTE was defeated, and the government now controls the full island and has tried to consolidate peace on its own terms after that. I'll be looking mainly at this part of the country, specific section in the northeast where I've done most of my fieldwork, Trincomalee District, and in many ways it's a crucible of the country, at least of the northeast at large, where many of the larger developments come together. To cut it to a chase and I guess give you an insight of what it might look like, I've just chosen three examples and I'm taking them a little bit out of context, so forgive me for skimming over a lot of things. But I think these three cases show the contradictions around integrating the northeastern frontier in Sri Lanka. Firstly, the special economic zone in Sampu. Now, special economic zones are a very familiar theme in Asia, initially in China, later in India, and now they're spreading all over the region, particularly in South and Southeast Asia. And it's a classical way of creating a zone of exemption, managing integration with the outside by creating a particular zone that you can control, allowing certain flows to come in, capital mainly, allowing other flows to go out, labor in a way, but at the same time controlling the conversion, the interface between the internal and the external. So it's a way of attracting foreign firms. It's a classical strategy, and it makes sense for Sri Lanka to do that, and it has in the south as well. But this special economic zone is not your average special economic zone. First of all, Sampur was one of the main LTTE hubs in the eastern province, so it was a strategically military area. They had their guns there because the Trincomalee Harbour is an important navy harbour, so it has a major security importance. Secondly, when the government conquered it in 2006, they actually converted it into a high security zone. It was a military zone. Basically, the military was in charge, and no people were allowed to enter or return to their homes after they were driven out. And then it was turned to a special economic zone, and the interesting thing is that it didn't actually make that much difference. It was still under the control of the military. People weren't able to go back, and nobody quite knew what was happening, including many of the civil servants who were actually supposedly administering the region. The military kept them out. So it was a very militarized kind of special economic zone. Because the town population, including some high-caste families, were not allowed to return, they started to resist and deliberately resist being relocated, stayed in the refugee camp, generating international protests, notably from some of the UN agencies, as well as Tamil politicians in Tamil Nadu in India. So it became a major sort of rallying issue for the Tamil groups there to argue against the government. At the same time, the economic project wasn't taking off. There's talk about a power plant that's not really happening. The idea of attracting companies isn't really working out either. So this idea of a special economic zone as the sort of classical way of integrating a frontier and creating an area for attracting capital clearly isn't working. And in many ways, it's a continuation of war by other means. There's a strong discourse of occupation and militarization rather than integration. So the second one is a much larger, much more contentious and longer-term set of issues, settlement schemes. And as I mentioned, this was something that started long before the war and has partly a developmental imperative, if you like, of bringing landless farmers from the south to new livelihoods in the northeast. How could you be against that? At the same time, it's very strongly ethnically coloured. And a lot of Tamil-speaking people in the northeast worry about bringing in singular farmers and changing the ethnic demography, changing the electoral demography as a result as well. So this is where you get into the talk of hydraulic nationalism, using irrigation scheme to further a nationalist project with the idea of modernist development. That's the longer-term story. Now, the particular region we're looking at, Veli Oya, in fact, is the most controversial among several schemes. Firstly, because it was the last to actually be implemented in the late 1980s when the war had already taken off, and secondly, because of its location. It's in the very northern tip of what used to be the singular populated area, and from a minority perspective, it's about bisecting a Tamil homeland, bisecting Tamil Elam, creating a bridge from the singular heartland, if you like, to the sea, thus taking the east and the north apart. So it has a very strong military political overtone. Now, many of these singular frontier men, women, if you like, obviously had a pretty hard life. They were put there in the 1980s. The war happened. The LDTE strongly moved against them, and many of them moved out. Many of them also stayed. And they see themselves as having held the fort, having held ground, seeing themselves as making a major contribution to the nation and to the war effort. Many of them were actually in the military force or in other kind of vigilante systems. So this is not just an innocent farmers project. They know they serve particular roles, and in some ways they've taken the flak for it as well. Now, after the war, in many ways you could say things are picking up where they were left off. The LTDE is defeated. Farmers that were driven out are coming back. New farmers are coming in. So colonization, if you like, is continuing. But, of course, the story is more complicated than that. It's not just sort of rolling over, steamrolling the north and east, because there's a lot of resistance against it from the Tamil, to a lesser extent the Muslim side, strongly internationalized. And at the same time, there's economic forces, because a lot of these Sinhala farmers aren't all that happy to be put back in those dry areas without facilities and lots of malaria. So there's the economic rationale of sort of putting farmers in the northeast no longer really adds up. It doesn't add up the way it added up 30, 40 years ago. The economic logic of the nostalgic idea of Sri Lanka being a farming nation actually no longer really adds up. So the economic forces and the political imperative actually clash in this case for the Sri Lankan government. Finally, and this is just a little note, so far I've talked about state intervention and government schemes, if you like. This is a slightly different set of issues. During the war, the Northeast was a very curtailed and sort of isolated part of the world. So it wasn't completely cut off, but in many ways it was. Very difficult for people to move in and out. And as a result, in some ways, parts of that part of the world actually froze in time in the 1980s. You saw very old cars driving around, and you saw people living lives that you would have seen elsewhere in Sri Lanka much longer ago. After the war, suddenly you see that opening up. The security regime changes. It's safe to travel at night. The curfews are lifted. People aren't so afraid anymore. The checkpoints are gone. Bridges are built. Roads are being reconstructed. The ferries start running again. The buses start running again. There's cell phone coverage throughout the district, not just in the main town. Internet connection. So people are actually being reconnected to the world in a very rapid pace. And this creates the kind of anxieties and worries that you get all over the world when globalization comes through the floodgates in a slightly higher pace than people might have anticipated. So you have more anxieties, not just about singular occupation, if you like, but also about the kinds of things that we don't normally associate with the end of a war. People worrying about the youth hanging out and falling in love and doing all kinds of other things, hanging out in the junction, having a drink and coming home late, people being more interested in their cell phones than in actually doing something useful, traditional norms and forms of respect eroding, tourists coming in and wearing strange kinds of clothing and having noisy parties at night, evangelical churches, who of course were never absent, but now suddenly have a much freer hand to moving around the whole region. So there's a lot of new things that come in, and the confusing thing about it is that usually when a bad thing happens in this region, it has an ethnic color and you can blame it on the government. But both really don't apply here, because this is something that the Buddhist monk is equally worried about as the mullah or the Hindu priest. And this is something that you can't blame the government about, because the only thing they did is connect the phone connection and build the road, which is a good thing. So it's a confusing time, and in many ways it's opening up to the world creates very unpredictable anxieties and new forms of conflict that are different from the plots that we know. So it's something that we can't blame on the government. So just to come back to that picture, we came from here, we're going up there. Yes, it is being integrated, and yes, it is in some ways less conflictual, no doubt about it. I don't want to be sort of dismissive of the fact that life has improved massively, also in the north and east. But in many ways, the way this development, the way this integration takes place is sowing seeds for future conflicts to come. It's not addressing many of the structural issues underlying the conflict. In some ways, it's reinforcing them. So the overall point to make is not all good things come together. It's economic development and political integration and peace are not necessarily the same thing. In many ways, they work at cross purposes. And yes, development efforts and integration produce ambivalent results. There's good things about it. People appreciate the roads and the opportunities, the job opportunities in the trade, but they're also worried about many aspects of it. And it has also produced a re-entrenchment of the ethnic conflict in many ways. And of course, as I showed, there's a long historical trajectory here. In many ways, what we see is not surprising. It reconfirms things that have happened for a very long time. There's a longer plot here. It's not about one government or the other. It's much more structural than that. And at the same time, there's a lot of specific issues at this present moment. It has a lot to do with the way the war ended. Had it been an inclusive peace agreement, certainly the dynamics would have been different from now, where we have a military victory. Perhaps a little bit of a hopeful note. As you probably know, we had a bit of a political landslide in Sri Lanka just a couple of weeks ago, with a new government coming in, which has made a lot of promises about doing things very differently from the previous government, and it has actually met some of those promises already. So who knows, the policy for the Northeast might be quite different, but I guess as an academic, it's my job to be cynical, so I'm saying it's too early to say. Thank you very much. I'll pass right on to Rachel.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up where Bart left off in addressing some of the structural issues as being important to conflict mitigation and amelioration. I'd like to make three key arguments. One, the first relates to the importance of examining subnational context and really understanding the dynamics there, particularly in frontier and borderland regions. For understanding subnational national linkages and subnational global linkages. And a part of that story is how people are organised and organise themselves at the local level and the degree to which there's inequality there. And there's a difference between inequality between individuals and inequality between groups. So you've probably all heard of the Gini coefficient, or the index which lines up people against each other and says how much are you earning vis-a-vis your neighbour, and that's behind the statistics that we see that say 10% of the 90% of the world's wealth is owned by 10% of the population and so on. Group-based inequalities are about measuring how groups line up against each other and understanding that your group identity, and in the areas where I work it's usually your ethno-religious identity, can open up access to resources, to opportunities, or can constrain them. And it reminds me of a little bit of an example yesterday where I went to the bathroom towards the end of the lecture before lunch, and I came out and I followed a group off to have lunch, and I sat down and I, you know, got my lunch. It was this lovely rare grilled beef and so on, and I started chatting to the guy next to me, and eventually he looked at me and he said, I think you're in the wrong conference. And so, you know, I was eating this sort of very nice lunch, and I came back out and I joined the other group, and we were sort of handing sandwiches and coffee. And this is what people face on an everyday level when your identity matters. And it turns out that the other conference was a whole heap of defence people in the Attorney General's office. The second point I'd like to talk to is, you know, that conflict doesn't just happen. There's a whole set of conflicts, of complex mobilisation processes, and the important role of local elites, local leaders, and so on in that. And the third point I'd like to make is that, you know, these frontier regions and borderland regions are not something that the state does something to. They both shape and are shaped by state-building processes at the centre. But they have very unique histories that sometimes intersect with national-level trajectories and sometimes go off on their own paths. So I've been doing research in Central Sulawesi for the last 10 years on and off, and I picked this region for a number of reasons. First of all, there was a whole heap of reports being published by the ICG and others on the terrorist networks in this region, the training ground for jihad groups, one of the bases of Jamal Islamiyah and sort of regional terrorist networks. And yet my experience prior, you know, I'd been working in Indonesia for a long time, was that wasn't necessarily the whole story. It's one of a number of conflict regions in Indonesia where conflict, very intense communal conflicts, mini civil wars in fact, broke out in five provinces in Indonesia, all on the periphery, all in the borderlands or frontier regions. Ambon, Poso, so in the Maluku's, Central Sulawesi, West Kalimantan, you can see from the map, and of course there's issues in Papua and Aceh as well. So I went out to the area and I conducted research in two neighbouring districts. And the idea behind this is I wanted to explain why violence didn't occur everywhere and why you do need to understand in the subnational context. Because even though there was this outbreak of violence in a whole range of regions in Indonesia, it didn't happen everywhere and it took different forms. So I wanted to explore why that was the case. And you don't really need to worry so much about the names of these districts. Just look for yellow. Yellow means less conflict affected and red means more conflict affected. But the point was these two districts were very similarly structured. So they had two large religious groups, Muslim, Christian, and four to five ethnic groups. And actually I did very similar research with a very similar methodology in Nigeria and found very similar findings to what I'm about to present here. So there's a larger common story that we need to think about. And using a whole different range of research techniques, both large N surveys and very detailed fieldwork, I collected a whole heap of different information about identity, inequalities and so on in these areas. And one thing that we all know is, we wear multiple hats. Our identity isn't fixed. It's important sometimes and not others. And we asked people, what's the most important aspect of your identity in your everyday life? And what you can see from this chart is that in the conflict-affected area, neighbourhood was incredibly important. But next door, it was less so, and religious identity was very important. But in the neighbouring area where religious identity was important, nobody mobilised around that. So it's not about which religious groups are sitting in a particular area and they're always fighting each other. It's not about religion. It's about, how people emphasise their identity and why at particular points in time. And this very much relates to the fact that there were, a series of political settlements in the conflict-affected area which made mobilisation more feasible. And I collected a number of indicators of local level inequalities, subnational inequalities in these different areas and across different sources. So this chart shows that in our conflict affected and less conflict affected area, in the less conflict affected area, the distribution of wealth between how many people fit in the poorest of categories, be it zero, and how many people fit into the wealthiest categories, be it three, there was very little difference in how wealth was distributed in the society in the less conflict-affected areas. But in the place where there was fairly extreme conflict, you found that there was a concentration of wealth within one group. And there was a high level of poor people within the other group. And what's interesting here is that the distribution of wealth, or how many richer people there were, there was very unequal group size among elites. So there was elite level inequality, and you have to look at how wealth is distributed within groups as well as between groups. So basically what this is showing is that there was competing interest among elites in a conflict affected area and less so next door. And actually, I heard time and time again when I was there that for a very long time, we'd had the Christian and Muslim communities in the conflict-affected area had been sharing powerful positions. So they'd rotate the district head back and forth each period between each group. But towards the end of the basically late 80s onwards, when Suharto's regime became increasingly authoritarian, they're also increasingly dropping central government officials into positions of leadership out in the frontier areas. They were usually Muslim. The Muslim networks were strengthening. It was a sort of a symbolic representation of the power of the state. And those power-sharing relationships started to break down. And this is during the onset of the conflict, which you don't see in the literature around the role of jihad and jihad groups and militants and arms flows in this conflict area, is what was happening in the background in local politics prior to massive escalation. And what this shows is that, in the distribution of civil service positions, for example, roughly those positions were shared both in nominal numeric terms and also relative to the demographics of the area. But over time, you know, there was increasing control of the state by one side. So they were controlling the economy and they were controlling the local civil service. So there was a number of tensions there which were ripe for throwing the flame into the tinderbox at the time of the end of the authoritarian regime. Meanwhile, what did that mean in terms of the eyes of the local populace? Did they care, or was this just an elite narrative that was playing out locally? Well, in fact, you know, when we surveyed people's views on how important inequalities were and how important your religious identity was to being able to access various opportunities to improve your well-being at the local level, we found that in the conflict-affected area, and this was conducted sort of not at the height of the violence, but still during the larger conflict period, you know, nearly half the people, and this holds over different income groups, this holds over gender, this holds over occupation and so on, really thought that there was preferential treatment for one side and not the other in the conflicted area, but this was significantly less so next door. Government contracts mattered, jobs, contracts, private sector formal jobs are all affected by your group identity. So it was becoming very, very salient which group you belonged to. And actually, when you follow the narrative of mobilisation and how people mobilised, at one point, you know, Christians were wearing red, Muslims were wearing white. They're also, the conflict narrative was playing along these salient identity lines. So there was this growing discourse of difference. There were religious slurs written on walls in the middle of night that would lead to, you know, clashes between youth groups in the mornings. There was the targeting of political settlements according to whether you were Christian or Muslim, with burning down houses. And after a period of time, this got into the media, it got into the public discourse, it became a national issue, it became an international issue, and you started seeing flows of supporters coming in to support each side, both from other provinces. There was armed flows coming down from the Philippines and Mindanao. There was groups getting on boats from Java. There were monetary flows through alleged monetary flows through terrorist networks. You started to see a handful of people with experience in Afghanistan coming into the region, training local groups, and then the situation escalated and took some 8 years to reduce that. So it shows, this sort of demonstrates how you can have this local issues can link into global issues, because of course this is all playing out alongside the timing was important, because it was taking place at the same time as September 11 and this global discourse that we all know about. So meanwhile, conflict was raging in other provinces in Indonesia, and the networks started to form between combatants in those areas, and they started to agitate for similar kinds of things. We saw a heap of redistricting through decentralisation policy, which sometimes concentrated groups ethnically and religiously in demographic areas, but it also created new jobs, because by creating new districts, you're creating more powerful civil service positions, so you're sort of spreading the risk to a degree, but it's also meaning that you keep the competition between groups alive for access, and hence it has national implications, because Indonesia is now blown out to some 400 districts in the area, which, you know, has significant transaction costs. There was a whole other range of so these peripheral areas, also conflict affected areas, had long been agitating for varied degrees of autonomy through decentralisation, and you may have heard of Big Bang decentralisation in Indonesia, where there was a sudden implementation of decentralisation and creation of powers at the local level with the end of the authoritarian regime. But that wasn't anything new. There'd been agitations for that since the 1950s, and there's actually almost the text for the law that was passed in 1999 and implemented in 2001 was actually not dissimilar to the draft text that had been proposed in the late 50s, which wasn't eventually wasn't implemented. So this was there's a historical narrative and trajectory here too that's linking past and present, that's linking local and national, that's linking the demands from both sides. There was this was at a time when the military's role in politics was being rolled back, so hence the strategic interest for conflict to continue, because that means the creation of new territorial commands. So there was this relationship between the frontiers, between the borderlands, between the peripheral areas and central government policy. So if we sort of take quick stock of that sort of quite negative story of violent conflict escalation, the point I want to make is that, you know, in subnational context, intergroup inequalities, even perceived inequalities, whether or that they are not necessarily the case, it does increase the risk of violence. But my research has found in a number of countries that's particularly the case when that plays out along political lines. So exclusion, inclusion in the state, access to the state, all comes back to your ethno-religious identity and whether it has political salience or not. We saw in one place it did, we saw in another place it didn't. Discourse matters. This is what starts to link local issues nationally and internationally. How violence is ignited and sustained by elites, brokers and groups really matters. It doesn't just happen suddenly, and it's also quite difficult to resolve once you've had multiple episodes of violence, and it shapes mobilisation. Also, my research has found that, you know, as violence plays out, with the increasing scale of violence, the diversification of motivations for participation, be it jihad groups from other islands and other countries and local participants, that diversifies with the increased levels of violence. However, and I think this goes back to Bart's point that things can change, and this is not a static inequalities and conflict is not something that necessarily has to stay the status quo. What happened in central Sulawesi after a number of security measures and special operations to weed out particular leaders of fundamentalist groups was both at a national level and at a local level attention to some of the structural issues, which may not be the case yet in Sri Lanka, but has started to take place in Indonesia around redressing these inequalities. So the National Development Planning Agency has made both targeting regions, so regional inequality between provinces, trying to reduce that a key point in policy. And at the local level, local leaders recognised how important it was to start sort of better power sharing, better resource sharing and so on. So during elections, people run on joint tickets, Muslim-Christian leaders running in pairs rather than individuals. The targeting of development assistance, they always have as a backbone of local policy, thinking about making sure it's distributed between the salient groups. There was a new conflict management law drafted centrally to try and manage conflict and reduce inequalities and so on. And I was lucky enough to repeat some of this survey-based research some years later. And what this shows is you can see that, you know, back in the mid-2000s, the situation in Poso was, you know, there was much stronger perceived inequalities. But by 2009, it had shrunk back to the similar level of its neighbouring district, which hadn't experienced violence. So you can have positive impacts through policy change. So why do we care? And I'll wrap up. I wish I'd sort of put this on two slides, but anyway. We care because if you don't understand subnational conflicts and subnational contexts in frontiers and border regions, you may miss a very, very important part of the story of how things escalate into high levels of insecurity. The often areas of contestation, there's higher stakes for central government to control those areas. They're often areas where there's very large resource endowments. Little wonder then that climate change initiatives which are being implemented in peripheral areas are facing a number of problems, because they're new initiatives that can change the distribution of power and resources at that local level, and with all of those other dynamics that I've just talked about going on. So it makes it highly contentious. It's also, resource endowments are also often situated geographically, not only at frontiers, but at borderland areas. So you not only have these local dynamics going on, you have them going on the other side of the border. And with things like climate change, it's transgressing borders. So you have multiple interests on both sides, making it very complex to get new policies off the ground. Local areas can have global implications for insecurity, poverty alleviation and so on, because of those local global linkages. These sorts of issues affect how development policy and development programs are targeted. Where do you invest? How do you invest? How are you taking account of that local context? And in a time when the discourse of development policy is around scale and replicability, how do you do that when each context can be so different? And are programs, country programs, actually paying attention to these kinds of issues? So we believe that it's important to avoid this methodological nationalism of only looking from the centre out, and often within one state rather than from across the border, and actually working from subnational areas to explore the different, to make sure you don't miss the entire story. And I'll wrap up there.
Okay, we've got a bit of time. So we'll have a quick round of questions and have a go at answering them. This is what comes when you chair yourself. So, take a round, yeah? One, two, and half. Okay,
thank you. Yeah, so I guess my questions are directed at, well, I'm now at this university of Sydney, but asking more about the economic integration that might be happening in the north and east in Sri Lanka. And I guess a lot of my observations are drawn more from Kilimanjaro and Jaffna than from Trincomalee. But specifically whether ethnic and class divisions are converging in redevelopment in the north. I guess one thing I've seen in particular is, you know, like a lot of supermarket chains and shopping centres opening up in Jaffna. Presumably, a lot of the capital which goes into that comes from Colombo, from the Sinhalese economy, and all the labour comes from displaced, in some cases, Tamil population. And whether or not that's itself is a form of capital accumulation.
Thanks. Three very interesting presentations. I have two questions. The first for Rachel and Bart. One on the media conference. The first question is, it's related to the fact that you kind of equated the borderland to the frontier. I was wondering, in island nations, given that there isn't really a country on the other side of the frontier, whether you see the importance of the border between the non-frontier and the frontier, and if in fact how you would define that in terms of in cultural terms, as opposed to bureaucratic, administrative, or geographic, river-based, or mountain-based, or non-geographic sort of mountain-based. And the question to Jonathan is, with regard to the statement you made on the drug industry. You made a very interesting statement that the drugs business had actually helped to develop the rest of the country. The incentives perhaps for maintaining the drug industry are quite high, and how would a country such as Afghanistan try and replace an industry such as the drug industry given its moral sort of terms?
Yeah, thank you for three fascinating presentations. I was struck, well, one of the things I was struck by was what Bart said about kind of the spread of Facebook in Sri Lanka and parents' concerns about their children. I mean, it seemed quite a healthy development in terms of bringing communities together. And I guess it's a form of globalization that's coming in on top of these other conflicts between the center and the borderlands. And I just wanted to go to the two speakers. I mean, is there any spread of mobile phones in these remote areas of social media? And is that having any kind of impact for the sort of scene in the Northeast of Sri Lanka?
Yeah, I guess two main questions that I need to respond to. The difference between borderlands and frontiers, that's a pretty broad issue when we get around that. There's not one thing to talk about, I should keep it close to me. The difference between borderlands and frontiers is an important one. And they're kind of, it's not A or B, but there are the differences between one and the other. Treating Sri Lanka must obviously be a frontier. It doesn't mean there's no borderland. There are clear international dimensions in Tamil Nadu just around the corner. Your question about whether it makes a difference to be an island state or have, say, less natural kinds of borders, I can guess that's true, but clearly we don't want to get into sort of geographical determinism, thinking that islands are natural issues and all the borders are artificial. There's a lot of sort of fuzziness around Sri Lanka's international borders as well, and most of the fishery conflicts, there's other kinds of flows that make that less logical. I think there's a danger then of assuming that the world is a natural place to build things on. And we all know that whenever people say that, they have a political imperative to do so. So I wouldn't want to go in that lane, but look more carefully about what kind of difference, what kind of borders make. Regarding the economic dimensions, I think it's a bit of everything. Yes, the singular commerce is much more developed in many ways as commerce in North America. So you see the big companies coming in. That's aggravated by the fact that the military involved, you see military camps, plus a school, plus a shop, plus this and that. You see military labor being redeployed because the army is grown after the war and they have no war to fight, so they're doing stuff. So that's clearly, you know, what the minority sphere. At the same time, some of this is also natural. The fact that you have a fishery industry that now reaches out across the whole island, of course, raises Tamil concerns, and somewhere it's also natural thing to be happening. And it's not just the minority being on the receiving end. There isn't, you know, the extra funding, other kinds of economic flows are involved. And it's not that there's no sound economic development happening in Jaffa. I mean, that's that sort of, yeah, no simple answer to your question, as you know.
Sure, okay, yeah. I mean, just on the Sri case, there's also, I think, an interesting issue around this moral panic and globalization. That the LGT was seen as a stabilizing, a tech. I mean, it's a complicated story, but there was an element of the LGT that was seen as there was a predictability to relations. You knew where violence was coming from, the level of order. It was a repressive period. And then opening that now, it's more than uncertain and predictable. But going on to the issue of drugs, I mean, what I'm trying to show my writing on drugs, a bit in the presentation, is that there's a whole discourse around drugs which is very normative. And it's, if we strip away, and it's also about drugs exceptions, there's something inherently different about drugs from other commodities. And first of all, let's strip away the normative dimension and look at what's happening empirically. And let's reconnect drugs with other commodities and processes, and when you do that, I mean, okay, there are some important differences, but there's also a lot of similarities. And you then get into a complicated story that, in some ways, drugs have had some positive effects on the local economy and political relations. And if you try to sort of eradicate, as it has happened in some areas, you inevitably create structural conditions for a rebound, and you lead to a whole range of negative impacts anyway. So, and if we think about this historically, about how states have emerged, very often states emerge through the rates generated by illicit, illegal, semi-legal commodities, and then that's converted. So what I'm interested in this war economy, this peace economy issue, is about how these kind of illicit things over time are converted into illicit economies, and how the entrepreneurs are involved in making those decisions about So I'm just looking at one drug dealer on the border, who started off being involved in the drugs economy. He was there in 2007. He then got involved in the movie business. So we're shifting into kind of illicit but kind of shady dealing. Next time I was there, he went there in 2014. He was relocating a car in that illicit business. So how do those processes of transition at the individual level and at the national level happen? It's not to say that Afghanistan's long-term future is going to be one relies on the drug economy.
So just in response to, I think you're also asking about the border between the frontier and the international border. To me, I think that's probably context specific, but it's something I think we'll look at more in our new research project. I would say in the area where I've worked in Indonesia, that's a contingent on history. So over time, where the the points of tension geographically to the patch, you see that in Sulawesi, not central Sulawesi, where the push up from the south was in groups of particular points of history and down from the north. The colonisation and trade flows, the Dutch period, and that sort of their education infiltrated, and that sort of helps you see sort of frontier regional where states have less control as well. Something that we'll be looking at in our new research is around maritime borders, looking at some of the issues that are specific to that compared to, say, land borders. In the Malay-Indonesian border and the Singapore-Indonesian border, and how that kind of plays in. There's also application issues around climate change and so on. So I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm sure it will be explored in the future. But I find that seeing on the spread of telecommunications really interesting. I think that Indonesia did a sort of early skipped whole infrastructure development period, and it's straight to sort of the towers, mobile phones, and that spread very quickly. I remember working all the way out in East Tenggara back in early 2000s, and you'd be sort of trying to upload the internet in one computer that had internet in one town, and it'd take 15 minutes to get your Hotmail page and so on. And now, much of that has mobile phones. What's very interesting in Indonesia is that the number of mobile phone owners exceeds the adult population or population is moving to. That's a great thing because it means access to markets, access to information, local people, so if they're trading their rubber in the peatlands, they can keep an eye on the local rubber prices. But at the same time, from a conflict perspective, it's changed the way that mobilisation processes happen. And I remember talking to a general in Jakarta that could tell me exactly and stuff with very small incidents that exploded on the ground because of the mobile phone. And similarly, out in northern Nigeria, where we've got the implication of Boko Haram and other conflict issues there, it spreads like wildfire, rumours, inciting events, and so on, just by spreading the food on the ground. So it's got sort of positive and negative.
I was on the phone in 2007, I was in the border areas. The drug dealers used sat phones to no one else happened to my boss. And now the Art and Calm program in the North Indies is just a very big dilemma. Anyone has a mobile phone.
But I don't think it produces the same sorts of anxieties necessarily. It's not been something that's come up naturally as an issue in my research. So. If it hasn't been deliberately mocked up either, because of the nature of the geography of Indonesia, you can get in information into multiple angles.
It's one of the points about all three presentations that these borderlands are not suffering from being disconnected. They're highly connected in different ways. The drug economy is a great example. It's a little what we're trying to explore, what the terms of that connection, who's better.
Thank you. sorry, I'm going to have to cut you all off here. Go step in, and everyone please join me in thanking you.
Been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.